Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later on today's program, Pennsylvania's U.S. Senator Pat Toomey, and also 30 years after Operation Desert Shield. But up front, when 19-year-old Peyton Walker died suddenly in 2013 of sudden cardiac arrest, her loss left her Cumberland County family reeling. They harnessed their grief into action, starting a foundation in Peyton's name to save other families from knowing the pain and heartache of losing a child from SCA. Pennsylvania recently passed Peyton's Law, making the state only the second in the country to enact legislation to educate parents about SCA and the importance of heart testing. Joining us is Julie Walker, Peyton's mother and president of the Peyton Walker Foundation. Julie Walker, good to have you back on the program.
Thank you so much, Scott. We are so excited to be here to share our incredible news today.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Julie, I know that this has been a long haul for you, but what is Peyton's Law designed to do?
Well, let's talk real quick about sudden cardiac arrest. It is the leading cause of death on school campuses and the number one killer of student athletes in our country. And all too often we see these tragic headlines of kiddos dropping over dead on the basketball court or on the football field or during practice without warning. They had undiagnosed heart conditions. So what we set out to do, you know, after losing Peyton, we learned so much about sudden cardiac arrest, and I have met far too many families who've lost their kids to an undetected and undiagnosed heart condition. And we said, you know what, we've got to change this. What can we do? So thankfully, we had great leaders in Texas, the Cody Stevens Foundation. They worked for almost 7 years to get legislation passed there. Once it was passed there in Texas last year, I said, you know what, we're going to do this in Pennsylvania. Went and met with Senator Mike Regan and his team, and we said, look, we have a way that we can save some young lives. So what Peyton's Law is going to do is when parents and students have to fill out their PIAA pre-participation forms, there will now be information on there about electrocardiograms and what an integral and potentially life-saving simple test that can be to help save a young life. So they have to sign off on this information. Parents will know about the importance of EKGs. They can ask their physician or their whoever does the sports physicals to do an EKG. They'd have to pay for it on their own. But EKGs are such an important test, and they can show it's kind of an EKG is a visual showing of what the electrical activity of the heart looks like. And those are the issues, the electrical issues, are what leads to sudden cardiac arrest. So thankfully, a simple electrocardiogram can find two-thirds of conditions that can lead to SCA.
So none of that information up until now has been readily available or was made available to those who were going to play a sport.
That's correct. So in the pre-participation packets, there's information about sudden cardiac arrest, which is wonderful, but unfortunately, there was not information on how we can help to prevent and detect issues that can lead to sudden cardiac arrest. So this is a game changer, and I have to say, Scott, for Pennsylvania to be second in the nation to implement and enact this type of legislation, I mean, that's trailblazing. This is just absolutely incredible, and we've been contacted by several other states that want to take this legislation, copy it, and get it introduced in their states and hopefully passed as well.
Okay, so providing the information is one part of this, but what about actual testing to make sure that, well, you mentioned EKGs, what about actual testing to find out if a young person may have a heart issue?
So here in the central Pennsylvania area, the Peyton Walker Foundation, offers free heart screenings throughout the year at different schools. Unfortunately, our screenings are on hold right now. There are other foundations that provide free screenings, but what we want to do is educate parents so that when you take your child to a sports physical or to a well child physical, ask for a baseline electrocardiogram, and typically that is covered by insurance. If you ask for the baseline EKG, I mean, they should also look at family history, any signs and symptoms. They should have, you want your physician to take the full picture of everything that's going on. Eventually, we'd love to see electrocardiograms become the standard of care. So anytime you go for your you know, routine checkups, you get that as a standard of care.
What about, now this is just athletes or those who are playing a sport, what about non-athletes? I mean, most kids, if not all kids, in high school will be in gym class. What about that?
Exactly, and that is an issue, because sudden cardiac arrest does not discriminate between athletes and non-athletes. The prevalence is across the board. This law, reaching the parents of athletes, that's kind of the low-hanging fruit for us. That's the easier group for us to meet, and so we're going to be launching an enormous educational campaign, raising awareness. And we figure if a parent has an athlete and knows to get that athlete screened and they have a non-athlete, hopefully they'll get both kids screened. I can't imagine screening one kid and not the other. So we hope it will trickle down, this education and information, so parents take advantage of this and learn and know to get their kids tested.
Let's go back to 2013. I know this is a painful memory for you with the loss of your daughter, Peyton, at the age of 19. Did you know that Peyton had some problems with her heart before suffering SCA?
Yes, and we have a very different story than most families. I was diagnosed with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy when I was in my late 20s. Once they found it in me, because it is a genetic issue, they started testing my children. We found it in Peyton when she was in fifth grade. So a very unusual case. She was under the care of a cardiologist. She was on medication. She had restricted activities. And it, with all of that education, it still happened to us. So we can't eliminate or eradicate sudden cardiac arrest. We are still going to lose kids to this, unfortunately. But what breaks my heart is how many people I have met on this journey who had no idea that their kids had an undetected heart issue, and they get a call, or, you know, they find their child went to bed and never woke up. So we can change that dynamic. We know that simple testing can help to reduce the sudden cardiac deaths in our young.
Well, let's bring in one of those parents, Deneen McCormick. She is the mother. Her son is named Whistler. Whistler was diagnosed with a heart condition at the first screening held at Trinity High School in 2015. Ms. McCormick, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you very much.
Tell us about that. Did you have any idea that your son, I understand that everyone calls him Wiz, did you have any idea that he had a problem with his heart?
No, not at all. I adopted my son from Haiti, and part of the adoption process, he was 7 when he came home, and we went to Children's Hospital in Philadelphia for a complete physical, and they gave him a clean bill of health. So, you know, I was like, okay, everything must be fine. And we moved on with our life. And then there was the opportunity to go for the screening, and I thought, let's do this. It can't hurt. I'd rather have the information and be able to deal with an issue than be blindsided by it.
So basically, you were just taking a chance that you just wanted some more information, but you had no idea that Whistler had a heart problem.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what happened in 2015 at the screening at Trinity?
Well, we registered online, and we had the appointment, and Wiz and I went in together, and the process ran very smoothly, went from station to station, and one of the stations we got a printout of the EKG, and they said, just take a moment and sit at the table here, and we'll get in touch with, we're going to have somebody review it, and we'll get back to you. So we put our EKG down, and there was other students and parents there, and they put theirs down, and ours didn't look like theirs. But I was like, well, maybe it's just a little different. And one by one, the people from my table were told everything was okay and they could leave, and we were still sitting there, and my heart started pounding. And then they said, well, we'd like to do one more test. Okay, that's great. We'll go back and do that test. And that was a sonogram of his heart, and that went on for 45 minutes, and the technician was great. She told me what was going on and everything, but I was like, pretty terrified. I was like, what's going on? This can't be happening. And we learned from that that we needed to follow up with a cardiologist and see what was going on.
I mean, I know there are privacy rules out there. Can you talk about what Whistler's diagnosis was?
Yes, he has left ventricle hypertrophy with non-compaction, which is a birth defect where your heart starts out as a very stringy organ, and as the baby grows in the mother's womb, it turns into a complete heart muscle. And part of his heart did not turn completely into a strong muscle, so it's sort of stringy.
So how have you and Whistler, how have you had to change your life, your lifestyle, how he lives, how he eats, how he exercises as a result of this?
Well, I think knowledge is power. And so we did a lot of research. We go to a cardiologist every 6 months, and he'll do a stress test on the treadmill. During one appointment, the next 6 months later, he'll do a heart monitor. Beyond that, his condition is under control. He needs no medication. He's allowed to participate completely in sports, any activities he wants to do, with the knowledge that if he would have any symptoms, he's to stop immediately and sit down. And we talked to coaches, and I sort of scare the coaches because I said, he's a tough kid. He's not going to just skip out of practice when it gets hard. But if he needs to stop, he's going to stop right there in the middle of practice, in the middle of a game. He will lay down. And they're like, okay. And I said, chances of him doing that are slim to none because, you know, he has no symptoms. Everything's fine. But Wisley's a normal life, no restrictions for diet, and exercise is good for him.
What sports does he play?
Well, he's now in his 20s and working,
okay.
So he doesn't get to play. But he was a two-time national speed skating champion. He skated in Europe. He's a soccer player. He played baseball, basketball, any sport.
Yeah, so he was exerting a lot of energy, put it that way. Do you look at that screen as maybe a lifesaver?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I follow sports, and I remember watching Hank Gathers go down on a basketball court and couldn't imagine it. And you see it more and more, you know, on the news. And I couldn't imagine being a parent in the stands and seeing something like that happen and being powerless. Now, with the Peyton Walker Foundation, we were able to team up and raise money to provide 3 AEDs within our community. So when Wiz was playing soccer, on the sideline, there's an AED. So that gives me peace of mind and knowing that, you know, Peyton's looking over us and we'll be okay. You know, if something happens, they've got an AED right there for us.
What is an AED?
It's an automatic electronic defibrillator that shocks the heart. And, you know, if there's an electrical problem with the heart, it shocks the heart and has the potential of reviving the person.
Well, Denise McCormick, I want to thank you very much for telling you and Whistler's story. And, I think that you made a great decision back in 2015 to get that screening.
Thank
you very much for being with us. Julie, a story like that has to make you feel good.
It is amazing, and we know we have sent other kids for surgical corrections. There's other kids that are being followed on medication, and I've had kids walk up to me and parents walk up to me and say, you know what, gosh, thank you. You probably saved my child's life. It is gratifying. It is absolutely gratifying knowing that this work is saving lives of young children.
So, Julie, when does this law take effect? Governor Wolf signed it just a couple weeks ago.
Right. So it takes effect in 60 days. So I believe mid-September it will be effective. So parents need to know, watch for this educational information when you are filling out your future pre-participation forms through the PIAA. But start having the conversation. Parents, coaches, everyone needs to get ready for this information that's coming. And also, like Deneen said, too, you know, getting electrocardiograms is very important, but also making sure that there's an AED on the field where the kids play and practice sports. That's absolutely critical.
Julie Walker is president of the Peyton Walker Foundation. Julie, thank you very much for all the work you do, and thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Democratic congressional leaders in the White House are in negotiations for another coronavirus relief package. The House, with Democrats in the majority, has already passed a wide-ranging bill that includes continuing $600 per week to the unemployed and billions for states and cities. Republicans have been resistant to such a large spending plan, saying the $600 in additional unemployment compensation discourages some workers from returning to their jobs. It's just one of the issues we'll discuss with Pennsylvania's Republican U.S. Senator Pat Toomey. Senator Toomey, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. We only have a short amount of time, Senator, so I want to try to cover as many issues as possible. You have voiced your opposition to the Democrats' bill. Why?
It's a staggering amount of money that would go in many, many directions that are entirely unnecessary and inappropriate. I think it would slow down the recovery. Look, at a fundamental level, you got to ask yourself, do you think that federal taxpayer money can be a substitute for having an economy? I think the answer is no. What we did in March was, under absolutely extraordinary circumstances, we decided we would replace lost income for virtually any American that we could identify as having lost income, and we would pay the payroll for small business, and we'd provide liquidity for big business. It was $3 trillion. Much of it has still not gotten to the intended beneficiaries. It turns out we way more than replaced lost income for people, and the data on that is very clear. And now, fortunately, we're in a very different place. We're in a place where we don't have states in a lockdown. We have all of our states have reopened overwhelmingly, maybe not every last industry. Nightclubs and restaurants are still restricted, but the vast majority of our economy is open. And our policy now should be about enabling people to get back to work, to restoring their careers and their jobs and their ability to provide for their families. That's what we should be focusing on, not a bill that would attempt to continue to be a substitute for the economy.
When you say a substitute for the economy, you're talking about the trillions of dollars that this bill has. You could probably tell me. I mean, we're talking up to $2.5 trillion, I believe. You're saying that that is a large percentage of the American economy overall. Am I reading you correctly?
Yeah, sure. Think about what we already did, right? We already passed a $3 trillion bill, and in that, we authorized the Fed to complement that spending with lending that could easily be more than $3 trillion. Call it $3 trillion. That's $6 trillion combined. That, by itself, is about 30% of the entire annual economic output of the entire United States of America. We've already done that. They want to send out another roughly 7% of our entire annual economic output. I stress that because, you know, this is not a 12-month problem. It hasn't been. I mean, we are already have begun to, as I said, almost completely to reopening the economy. It was a few months. It was terrible. We replaced lost income. We provided small business with the federal government paying for the payroll of small business. We provided liquidity for big business. And now it's time to get back to having an economy.
There is much to this bill, obviously, but the three parts that seem to get the most attention, and I just want to ask your opinions on these three. One is continuing the $600 a week unemployment compensation for those who haven't gotten their jobs. We still have an unemployment rate of around 12% here in Pennsylvania. Relief for states and cities. States and cities really going to be hurting. School districts really going to be hurting. And another $1,200 payment to most Americans for stimulus. Of those three, do you support either of the three, any of the three, or which ones do you support?
First, let's talk about the unemployment insurance. First of all, the $600 that you're talking about is above and beyond whatever the states ordinarily pay. In Pennsylvania, the maximum is $561 per week if you have no dependents. You add $600 on top of that, we're currently paying people, as long as they don't work, paying them the equivalent of $60,000 a year. Is that a good idea? I don't think so. I think that's way more. Look, we've had unemployment insurance for many, many decades. We've gone through many severe recessions over the course of all those decades, including the Great Recession back in 2008, 2009. And it never occurred to anyone that we should pay people much more money to not work than they make when they work. So the idea that we would extend that still further, that makes no sense to me at all. We should be, at a minimum, quickly phasing out the additional plus-up. Mind you, if a state decides it wants to be even more generous with its unemployment benefits than it is now, and states have different approaches, they can do that. Nothing stops that. So I don't think it makes sense for us to continue the $600 a week. As far as the money to the states, you know, some of our colleagues speak with a very short memory. A few months ago, we sent $500 billion to states. It's not clear that the hole in their revenue is that big. They certainly don't have expenses that are that high. And much of the money that we sent them, they still haven't allocated. In Pennsylvania, there's still $1 billion in reserve that has not been allocated. Much has been allocated to the counties, and there's some that went directly to counties. But there's $1 billion that hasn't been allocated at all. So it's not clear what is it actually needed there. And then the direct payments, what we know for a fact is the vast overwhelming majority of those payments went to people who never had any lost income. Think about all federal employees who never had any suspension of their income, but they got $1,200 a check. The vast majority of people didn't lose their job. I mean, if we're going to do something like this, I think it ought to be directed at people who've been adversely affected. But people who never lost a penny of income, why would we be going further into debt and printing more money so that those people can be getting $1,200 checks? That doesn't make sense.
So you oppose all three of those?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. The $600 a week unemployment, let me just ask a question about that. There are Democrats, including your colleague here in Pennsylvania, Senator Casey, who said that it is a myth that there are some people that have not returned to their jobs because they're making more money on unemployment than they would at their jobs. You disagree?
Yeah, I mean, that's like saying if you leave $100 bills on the sidewalk, it's a myth to think that someone's going to bend over and pick one up. Why would anyone do that? It's ridiculous. Of course, if you offer to pay people much more money to sit at home, to stay home with their kids, to do projects around the house, if the government says, look, we'll pay you much more to do that than if you go to work, why would someone go back to work? Yeah, I get. Some people do anyway. But there's no question that there are a lot of people who aren't going back to work. I don't blame them. We've got 5.5 million, according to the Labor Bureau, 5.5 million job openings in America, while we have, like you say, an 11% unemployment rate. In part, it's because it's better to be unemployed right now.
There are some Democrats who said that, you know, this wouldn't be an issue. Now, I know we're talking about another issue coming into this. If the minimum wage, for example, was increased, what do you say to that?
Yeah, well, we'd just have a lot fewer jobs. We'd just have a permanent unemployment rate that would be much, much higher. Because there are a lot of business models that simply don't work at whatever arbitrary number the Democrats have decided on for today. And by the way, their unemployment arrangement ends up paying much, much more than the minimum wage. So even if the minimum wage were at their level, some of them are advocating for $15 an hour minimum wage, that's still much below $60,000. So, you know, they'd still be advocating paying people more not to work than the minimum wage. But the bottom line is, you know, there's a lot of industries that would just shut down and people would lose their jobs altogether if the government forced everybody to get paid at a level that in some cases is more than what they are able to produce. You know, you can't suspend laws of economics as much as some people would like to.
Obviously, as you're well aware, there is a lot of controversy, a lot of people using statistics on that issue. We'll talk about that some other time. Have an email here from Meredith in Hershey. Says, Pennsylvania residents are some of the oldest in the country. How does Senator Toomey plan to support old resident communities in nursing homes and assisted living centers in the next bill?
That's a great question. It's really important because that's where we clearly failed, right? I mean, in Pennsylvania, the coronavirus, COVID-19, it's almost fair to just call it a disease of nursing homes. 68% of all Pennsylvania fatalities happened inside the walls of nursing homes and senior assisted living facilities, and it's because we didn't do a good enough job protecting the vulnerable. So Senator Casey and I have had a bipartisan approach to this for a number of years, that long before COVID came along, we recognized that there were nursing homes that performed at a subpar level, that weren't doing the job that they ought to be doing. They weren't adhering to and reaching the standards of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. But we found there's a list of nursing homes that are failing to measure up, and that list was not made public, which is outrageous to me. I think a family ought to know which nursing homes are and which ones are not before they commit their loved one to a place that might not be getting this job done. I also think we ought to be prepared, and we have provided resources for PPE and testing, for both residents and staff, because this is where the vulnerability is, right? The vulnerability of this disease is not a healthy 18-year-old. That person can contract COVID-19, they're extremely unlikely, it's extraordinarily unlikely that they would die. They're even unlikely to get very sick. But an older person, or a person whose health is compromised, person in a nursing home, they're at a very high risk, and we should be doing everything we can to protect them.
The 18-year-old, you're right, in the statistics show that for the most part, they don't show a lot of serious symptoms, but they can pass that on, pass the disease on.
Right.
We have an email here from Lisa who says, you keep repeating we need to reopen the economy. That's easy to say without considering the impact of COVID-19 on those who work high-risk jobs while community spread is still uncontrolled in places like Lancaster County. For those who have jobs that allow us to work at home, the economy has never been closed. You can reopen everything you want. People like me will not return to bars, restaurants, theaters unless COVID-19 is under control or there is a vaccine. So reopening doesn't actually ensure that these businesses survive. Senator, there have been some businesses, some industries that have been harder hit than those, as Lisa says, where you can work from home.
Yeah, well, yes, absolutely. And people who have jobs where they can work from home often, they have not been very adversely affected, right? They work from home. They still get their income. But it's also important to distinguish. There are a lot of businesses where you can't work from home, but you can still conduct business safely. I'll take an example on the extreme. Outdoor construction never needed to be locked down. And in fact, in 47 states, it wasn't. Pennsylvania was one of three that put a prohibition against outdoor construction. Why do I say that? Because it's relatively easy to maintain the separation. You can wear a mask, you can do your job, you can maintain the physical separation, you're working outside, the risk of transmission is negligible. Now, at other settings, it may not be negligible, but it's quite small, and there are many, many Pennsylvania stories of factories and office buildings where they took the precautions, they spent the money to maybe make some modifications that they needed, they require people to follow the CDC recommended guidelines of distancing and mask wearing. And, I'm a big advocate for wearing masks. I think it makes all the sense in the world. And if you do those things, then the vast majority of businesses can function. Now, are some still going, can you have a concert in an indoor arena? Can you have a crowded nightclub? No, those industries are very, very adversely affected. Aviation, hotels, restaurants, there's the hospitality industry generally, no question, continues to be very hurt because people, even if they're available and their doors were open, they might not have the kind of customer traffic that is needed to sustain them. That I'm not disputing that. But that is a sliver of our economy. The vast majority of our economy is in some other industry, and that's what I'm talking about. That's what I'm saying. We need to get back to work.
We have an email here, and I know we only have a minute or so left, Senator, from Bruce in Mount Joy in Lancaster County. He says, first, nice editorial this AM in the Lancaster paper regarding Senator Toomey urging all to wear masks. That said, I am a lifelong moderate Republican. I did not vote for President Trump in 2016, as I was disturbed by his behavior then. After 3 years of enabling Trump by most Republican senators and representatives, what would you say to someone like me who is seriously considering crossing party lines for all elections in 2020?
So I've had many differences of opinion with President Trump. I don't feel like I'm responsible for his Twitter feed, and so I don't attempt to edit that. But when he actually does things that I don't agree with, I've pushed back. And sometimes I've been the only Republican to do so. Sometimes I've been in just a small handful of Republicans. But here's the problem. Whatever people might think of President Trump, an election is not a referendum. It's a choice. And the alternative to President Trump is Joe Biden, who is increasingly allowing himself to be swept up by the radical elements within the Democratic Party. It is no longer an exaggeration to talk about socialism among Democrats. They openly brag about it. And that's the direction that they're going to take the United States. And if Joe Biden is elected president and they take control of the Senate, then this country is going to look very, very different. We'll be much less free. We'll have a much less prosperous economy. We'll take significant steps in the direction of socializing this economy. That's a very, very bad development. That's what I would suggest someone to think about before they cross over.
Senator, there are a lot of people who would say, well, first of all, Joe Biden is a moderate Democrat. And yes, he has made some agreements with the Bernie Sanders supporters. But for the most part, I mean, like when the president is running these commercials saying that Biden supports defunding the police, or, you know, a lot of the other commercials that have been on the air, that those simply aren't true.
So if you look over his career, I would argue that it's a mischaracterization to say that Joe Biden was a moderate. Joe Biden was always in the middle of wherever he thought the Democratic Party was. And the Democratic Party used to be a very different party. 20 years ago, it was not unrecognizable. Bill Clinton, someone running on Bill Clinton's position, couldn't get elected in a primary for dog catcher today. They have moved so far left. Joe Biden has accepted that. He let Bernie Sanders dominate the writing of their position papers. He's advocated for massive, massive tax increases. He thinks that the Federal Reserve should be responsible for eliminating racial inequality in this country, which is absurd to assign that responsibility to the Fed. It's a long list. I'm not saying that Joe Biden is a full-blown socialist. I don't think he is. But I do think he will pursue policies that are going to take us in that direction.
So I'll just ask this question. You will support President Trump in 2020.
That's right.
Senator Pat Toomey, thank you very much for being with us today. Thank you for being with us.
All right. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk, and we have received a lot of emails, questions, or comments about Senator Toomey's appearance on Smart Talk. And let me just say that we have a short amount of time, tried to get to as many issues as we can. Hopefully, we'll have an opportunity, more time with Senator Toomey in the future, where we can delve into these issues a little bit deeper. 30 years ago this week, Saddam Hussein's Iraq invaded Kuwait, their neighbor to the south and home to 8% of the world's oil reserves. The American response is swift and started with a military buildup that included an international coalition of forces. 6 months later, Operation Desert Shield became Operation Desert Storm when the U.S. and coalition forces began to forcibly expel Iraqi forces from Kuwait. The war lasted only 43 days, but the murky aftermath still clouds the legacy of what should be considered a successful ending to the Persian Gulf War. To talk about this anniversary and what we learned, what happened, it's Dr. Conrad Crane, Chief of Analysis and Research for the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center in Carlisle. Dr. Crane, welcome to the program.
Well, always glad to be here.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Dr. Crane, the anniversary, the 30-year anniversary this week is when Saddam Hussein in Iraq crossed the border into Kuwait. I'm not going to take this chronologically, but what was Saddam Hussein thinking at that time?
Well, he'd had a dispute with other Arab nations for a while. He had felt he had been carrying all their water in the war with Iraq, with Iran, defending them from the Persian invaders. He had debts to them. He thought they should be helping him with his economy was in trouble. You know, as often happens, totalitarian leaders will try to get their people focused on some kind of an external problem when they have internal problems. He thought Kuwait owed him a lot of money for the support for that war against Iran. There had been a history of disputes there that, you know, Iraq claimed Kuwait as one of their provinces. He thought the United States might be distracted. He might have been misled by some comments from the American ambassador, which is still some controversy about that. But basically, he thought he could get in, take Kuwait, control a large part of the world's oil reserves, make up his financial debts from the war with Iran, and because of the fait accompli, he didn't think that the world would react much to it and would allow the Arab countries to kind of take care of their own problems.
Well, he kind of misread that. Why did the United States and President H.W. Bush react the way they did?
I mean, this is the beginning of the American unipolar moment. I mean, the Berlin Wall had fallen, the Soviet Union was breaking up. You know, George H.W. Bush saw the beginning of a new world order. Remember, he's a World War II veteran also, and his historical metaphor for what Saddam did to Kuwait was Hitler and Munich. You know, this first step of a totalitarian leader to expand, and if the world doesn't stand up to him then, he'll go for more. You know, they could see the path, first Kuwait, then perhaps Saudi Arabia. You know, and there is Iraq would try to spread its power throughout the Middle East. Again, you know, for Bush, this was his Munich. He was not going to let this stand. As he said, you know, this shall not stand. He saw a chance to rally the world against aggression. It was his great shining moment. I mean, there's so much promise. You know, he gets a coalition of over 40 nations together to stand up against this aggression. The American military redeems itself from the ignominy of Vietnam with a terrific performance. It just seems like, you know, President Bush saw this as a chance to really show how the world had changed and to really stand up to aggression that, like I said, he compared back to his experience in World War II.
It almost, since World War II, I'm not saying almost, I mean, I think it probably is, and you tell me as a historian and someone who has analyzed this, probably is the best example of leading a coalition of nations against an aggressive nation like Iraq. I mean, did we see anything before or anything since like that?
You could go back to World War II, I guess, with the Allied coalition that's built up there, but you're right. It was a phenomenal performance by President Bush and his Secretary of State, James Baker, to form this coalition. I mean, you even had Arab countries involved. You had an Arab corps that attacking to free Kuwait. You had countries like Japan who didn't want to furnish forces, but that helped pay for it. It was the world against aggression. You had a UN resolution against it that to provide legitimacy. You had the debate in Congress to authorize the use of force. I mean, it was almost a textbook application of force to deal with aggression and what, you know, President Bush saw as this new world order to come.
Going back to 1990, I remember at the time that Iraq had either the largest or second largest military in the world at the time. And I remember many people were saying, they were speculating of how many casualties that there would be, that this would be a long and bloody war. It didn't turn out that way. What happened?
Well, the American military since Vietnam had done an amazing transformation. It was, you know, that it was an all-volunteer force now with an outstanding level of competence of the individuals in it. You had brand new equipment, the M1 Abrams tank, the Bradley fighting vehicle, stealth aircraft, cruise missiles. There'd been a technological revolution, the advent of computers and information technology. I think Iraq had the fourth largest army
at
the time.
Okay.
So it was up in the top few, and
yeah.
and it was, but it was, we overrated it. I mean, we had seen it. It was supposedly a veteran force from fighting against Iran, which was a war that had really won. It supposedly battle hardened with top Soviet equipment. But as we found, we went into combat, that we had better equipment, we had better training, we had better leadership. We had prepared a force to fight against the Soviet Union in Europe, and we were fighting against a very poor Soviet clone. The Iraqis had Soviet equipment and were using Soviet tactics, but they weren't very good at them. We overrated them and what they had done against Iran. It was an amazing performance. By the military, it started with the long air campaign that pummeled Saddam's forces, and many of them deserted. The ground campaign was sweeping and much faster than the Iraqis could respond to it. It was a great performance, but again, as one of the many instant histories of the war called it was a triumph without victory. We won all the battles, but the resolution of the war was much more murky. And as a result of it, a decade later, we find ourselves in two other wars in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Okay, so let's talk about that. As I said, the war lasted only 43 days. There were something like 150 Americans that were killed during the Gulf War. This should have been a triumph beyond, what we had seen since World War II. But as you said, since then, we find that the results have been murky at best. To this day, there is controversy, probably not as much as what there was at the end of the war, about why President Bush didn't pursue Saddam Hussein, go to Baghdad. We know there was a UN resolution, but would have going to Baghdad have kept us from Afghanistan, kept us from going back to Iraq in 2003?
I mean, it's one of the great things about what if history is you can never be proven wrong. It's hard to speculate. I mean, the problem is none of the leadership, none of the American military leadership wanted to drive to Baghdad. They weren't sure what that would encompass. The coalition would have collapsed. I mean, the Arab nations would never have supported a drive to Baghdad. A lot of the other nations as well. It was not in the UN mandate. There was also a assumption that Saddam was going to fall anyway. I mean, it was no one thought he was going to survive. Now, there was some ineptitude in the peace agreement. General Schwarzkopf did not get any real instructions about the negotiations at Safwan, and he allowed the Iraqis to maintain use of their helicopters, which they helped to use to cut down, to basically beat down, destroy any dissent. We encouraged Iraqis to revolt, and Saddam and also the Republican Guard escaped as well. It was another thing that went wrong at the end of the war. It ended a bit too soon. And between the Republican Guard and his helicopters, Saddam was able to put down the any dissenting elements that rose up, and many would have resentment when we came in 2003 that we hadn't supported him back in 1991. Saddam eventually, if you look a year later, in 1992, and President Bush loses the election, is no longer in power, and Saddam is, and he could portray, look, I survived and you didn't. And he portrayed himself as a victor because he stood up against the whole world and they didn't take him out of office. It's all how you spin things. But going to Baghdad would have been, it would have just been the Americans. It was not something that we really had planned to do. And at the time, again, the assumption was at the time that Saddam would not survive anyway, that we didn't need to go to Baghdad for him to be removed by the Iraqi people.
Some people may ask, well, what does Afghanistan have to do with the first Gulf War? Osama bin Laden who is from Saudi Arabia, was from Saudi Arabia, used the presence of American forces in Saudi Arabia as one of his justifications for hating America and leading this charge against America. So there were some repercussions of American troops and I understand even down to the point where Osama bin Laden did not like the fact that there were women serving in the military on Saudi Arabia's soil. So there have been some repercussions beyond just another Iraq war in 2003, right?
Correct. Not correct. I mean, it is the primary reason for the rise of Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda is the presence of American forces in Saudi Arabia, the font of all the holy sites in Islam. He saw it as a blasphemous for Americans to be there, and again, that's the rise of Osama bin Laden. It's the rise of Al Qaeda. It leads directly to the assault on the Twin Towers. It leads directly to the whole global war on terror, and that's all a spinoff from the American presence in Saudi Arabia for Desert Storm and Desert Shield and beyond.
When we were talking, I'm going to take a step backwards. When we were talking about President Bush forming this coalition, the United Nations, there was a resolution in the United Nations that this country and President Bush followed. I get the sense that that was the last time that this country and the United Nations worked hand in hand without much disagreement. It's been a long time since the United States has worked with the UN like that.
I mean, it did the, well, on Iraq, definitely. I mean, there was a little more cooperation on Afghanistan. After the assault, after the attack on the Twin Towers, there was pretty, universal recognition that had gone too far. The United States needed international support. But it definitely was a unique time. I mean, it's even got the Russians are not blocking the resolutions, it's just the whole world for a moment. It's a bright shining moment. I mean, the whole world is working together to defeat this aggression. I mean, it really was, as like I said, President Bush really saw this as the beginning of a new world order that never quite came to fruition.
So, Dr. Crane, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. It was 30 years ago this week that Iraq crossed the border into Kuwait. So the legacy of the Persian Gulf War, what would you say? How would you describe it?
Well, I mean, there's a number of them. Obviously, it was the beginning of the American unipolar moment. It is the sole superpower. It was a masterful performance by President Bush and Secretary of State Baker, but it led to further conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq. America's position in the world now is one of fatigue from those conflicts as we kind of back off. American military has continued to drive on. I mean, this comes out of the ashes of Vietnam. It is continually recognized as the premier military force in the world. But unfortunately, military power does not always... It's not all you need to win wars. It's not all you need to solve problems, and that's kind of where we are today. And the question of, the question is, where does American leadership go in the future? And that's what we all have to face at this point.
You know, one of the things that when you talk about that legacy and remembering back at that time, the American military was not held in high regard after Vietnam. It seemed with the Gulf War that those who served in the military were once again honored and looked upon with some respect. Would you agree with that?
No, what everybody needs to do is go on the Internet and look for, I can't remember if it was Stand Tall, Stand Proud or Voices That Care, but remember that song that was recorded for the troops where he had all these sports figures and Hollywood figures and entertainment figures singing this song to show their support for the American troops, and that support has never waned. I mean, that is one of the real positive implications of this time, that there has always, from then, there's been a continued support for the American military that was just not there in Vietnam.
Dr. Conrad Crane is Chief of Analysis and Research for the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center in Carlisle. Dr. Crane, always good talking with you.
Yeah, I just want to end to throw in one pitch. We have a big Desert Storm display at our center that was supposed to start this month. Obviously, the virus has delayed it, but it'll be around in November. People ought to come by and see it. It's going to be great to show a lot of the highlights of our collection and be very, very educational for people about this whole conflict.
Dr. Crane, again, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, a couple environmental issues. The Great American Outdoors Act signed into law by President Trump yesterday. And Conestoga River Week, talking about some water and the environment that's coming up tomorrow. So be sure to tune in.